Genesis chapter 8 and verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I give you the green plants, I give you everything, but you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning from every beast. I will require it, and from man, from his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God has made man in his own image. And you be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark. It is for every beast of the earth I establish my covenant with you, that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth, and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. God said to Noah, This is the sign of the covenant that I establish between me and all flesh that is on the earth. Amen. We know God always blesses the reading of his own word. There's a little Peanuts cartoon. I'm not sure if you can read it on the screen. But in it, Linus and Lucy are looking through the window of the living room, watching the rain fall. And Lucy says to Linus, Boy, look at the rain. What if it floods the whole earth? To which the ever-confident Linus replies, It will never do that. In the 9th chapter of Genesis, God promised Noah that it would never happen again, and a sign of that promise is the rainbow. Looking again at the torrential downpour, Lucy says, You've taken a great load off my mind. To which Linus replies, Sound theology has a way of doing that. Sound theology has a way of doing that. And that's what God's promises do. They take a load off the mind. Sound theology brings peace and stability even in the rainbow. Think about it for a moment. Noah must have felt very nervous during the flood. God had poured out his wrath on mankind, and it's true that he had provided a way of escape for Noah in an extraordinary demonstration of his grace. But that demonstration of grace came out of the blue as much as the wrath that fell upon mankind and drowned the rest of mankind. Who was to say it wouldn't happen again? Who was to say that there wouldn't be a next time, that Noah and his sons and their wives would be the subject of a divine outpouring of wrath? And you see, sudden floods of judgment are not conducive to peace of mind. How could he trust a God who had previously punished the world and wiped out all of creation bar himself and his family? Well, he could trust God because God is a God who makes promises. Now, there are lots of places in the Bible where God makes promises, but this is one of the most significant. God makes promises, or what we say are called covenants. Now, a covenant is an agreement. It's a normal word. It means a coming together, and it means an agreement between two or more persons. And in the passage that's before us, God enters into a covenant with Noah. He makes promises to Noah. Now, we read first of all of that promise in Genesis 6 and verse 18, when God says, "I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you and your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you." God promises that he's going to make a covenant. Before the flood, God indicates to Noah that he's going to enter into a covenant. He's going to make promises to him. That is fulfilled in Genesis 9 and verse 8, the passage that we read together. "Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you." Now, it's this covenant, these promises that we want to look at this morning. So first of all, the promise of the covenant. In the covenant with Noah, God promises never to destroy the world with a worldwide flood. You see that in verse 11 of chapter 9. "I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood." He promises never to send this worldwide flood. It's a creation covenant. He promises to look after and protect his world, not just from flood, although that's specifically mentioned, but from other catastrophes too. Look at chapter 8 and verse 21. "And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, 'I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done.'" Verse 22, "While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease." God promises that the normal patterns and rhythms of life he will maintain. You see what God is promising? He is promising to maintain his creation. Now, notice three things about this covenant or these promises. Notice, first of all, it's unilateral. And by unilateral, I mean it's one-sided. God promises Noah. Noah doesn't make promises to God. So in verse, well, if you notice the use of the word "my" and "I" in these verses, in verse 9, "Behold, I establish my covenant." Verse 11, "I establish my covenant with you." Verse 12, "This is the sign of the covenant that I make." Verse 17, "This is the sign of the covenant that I have established." A covenant, in its normal usage, is an agreement between two or more people. People enter into an agreement with one another. So if you enter into a covenant to buy a house, you negotiate on the terms, whether the curtains or in the blinds or in the carpets are included. But here God announces his terms, and Noah enters into the covenant with God. He doesn't negotiate. God declares the terms of the covenant. A divine covenant, unlike an earthly covenant, is a sovereign declaration. So it's unilateral. Secondly, it's universal. This covenant is established by Noah and his descendants. Chapter 9, verse 9, "Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you." Now, if the world was wiped out at the flood, and it was, then this covenant is a promise to you and to me, to all the descendants of Noah. That's why it's sometimes called the covenant of common grace, because God in grace promises that he's going to maintain and look after his creation. And it's interesting when you read verses 9 and 10, God promises, makes promises to the animal kingdom, to all of creation as well. So this covenant is a unilateral covenant, it is a universal covenant, and it is an everlasting covenant. Look at verse 11 of chapter 9. Verse 11, we are told, I establish my covenant with you, that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Go down to verse 16. When the bow is in the clouds, I see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. God is saying, never again will there be these worldwide disasters and floods. Of course, there have been many localized disasters and floods, but localized in nature. But nevertheless, this is a wonderful promise because God is restricting himself, he's restraining himself, and he promises never to destroy the world. His omnipotence says that he could. His justice says that he should. But his mercy says that he won't. So it's a unilateral promise, it's a universal promise, and it's everlasting promise. The second thing I want you to notice this morning is the basis of the covenant. Now you'll remember from our previous studies in the life of Noah, how prominent grace was in his life. The key to understanding Noah's life is Genesis chapter 6 and verse 8. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, or as Alec Mateer, the commentator, translates it, grace found Noah. Now, grace is the unmerited favor of God. Grace is something that we don't deserve. God in his justice gives us what we do deserve. God in his mercy withholds from us what we do deserve. But God in his grace gives us what we don't deserve. Now, why did God wipe out the world in the first place? Because he was angry. Go back to Genesis 6 and verse 5. Genesis 6 and verse 5. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man. So sin is not just what you do, sin is what you are. And God sees what no one else can see. He can see the intentions, or as the NIV has it, the inclinations of the human heart. And he's provoked to anger, and he's provoked to wrath. Now go to chapter 8 and verse 21, to the portion that we read together. Chapter 8 and verse 21, and when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart, same words, is evil from his youth. So it's the same condition. The ark wasn't some experiment in Nazi-type social engineering where you wipe out the bad people. The intention of man's heart was still the same. His inclination was towards sin. And yet God promises that in his anger, he's never going to blot out the world again in this way. But yet he did. And the same sin that provokes the wrath of God still remains. It's still the same. But God says, I'm never going to do it again. In fact, it could be argued that in today's generation, that sin is greater than the sin that was manifested prior to the flood. Because Noah's contemporaries didn't have the technology that we have to indulge our sin. The printing press, cameras, televisions, the internet, weapons of mass destruction. We have those things. Now, man is not more sinful, but he has more opportunity to indulge those sins and fulfill the inclinations of his heart. But God says, never again will I do it. He was angry pre-Noah. He is angry post-Noah. But in grace, he says, never again. So in an earthly covenant, a husband and wife come together and they say, I will. In this covenant, God comes to us and he says, I won't. That's the covenant of grace. The covenant of grace. And people argue and they say, well, there's no such thing as common grace. Well, this covenant was made by grace because man remained the same. How can you say that there's no common grace? That God isn't good to the unbeliever because he makes this promise to all mankind, and not only to all mankind, but all living creatures on the earth. So the promise of the covenant, the basis of the covenant. Thirdly, the obligations of the covenant. Now, although all the covenants were unconditional and unilateral, that did not free those who God covenanted with of responsibility. With all covenants come obligations. When you are making promises, the husband makes a promise to his wife, I will. That's reciprocated by the wife. And she says, I will too. Now, of course, divine covenants are different in that it's God who makes those promises with us. They're not covenants between equal parties. But when God enters into a covenant with us, we have an obligation, a duty to fulfill the terms of that covenant. And you see that in the passage before us. The first is to utilize. This is our covenant responsibility to utilize creation. Look at verses 1 and 2. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall come upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. That sounds very like the first command that was given to Adam back in Genesis 1. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. And when Noah comes out of the ark, he's like a new Adam. He's like a second Adam. There's a new beginning for the human race. And just as God told Adam to be fruitful, fill the earth and subdue it, now he tells Noah to do exactly the same. Now, of course, the authority of man after the flood is based on fear. Before the fall, there was harmony in creation. But these two elements of filling and ruling were given both to Adam and to Noah. If God is king of creation, then man is his viceroy. Psalm 115 in verse 16. The highest heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth he has given to man. He has been given that position by God. And if you look at verse 3, he is now entitled to and commanded to eat flesh, to eat animals. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. As I give you the green plants, I give you everything. It's a great difference between Adam and Noah. When God established Adam and Eve in the garden, he gave them the fruits of the tree and the plants of the earth to eat. But with Noah, that's extended to include meat. Before the fall, with creation in harmony with itself, it seemed inappropriate that man would be a carnivore. But now God gives all of creation to man to utilize for the benefit of mankind. So do you see the obligation of the covenant? God promises never to destroy the world, but in return, he asks man to use the resources of the world for the benefit of mankind. All creation is given into his hands. He is to develop as far as he can, agriculturally, scientifically, technologically, architecturally, to enjoy all that God has given him. To sit back and be a spectator in our world is a violation of our covenant obligations. We are to be involved in creation and we are to utilize creation. So not only is he to utilize creation, but secondly, he has to respect creation. Look at verse 4. It's an interesting verse. But you shall not eat flesh with its life. That is its blood. Now, some scholars believe this is an early version of the Jewish dietary laws that animals had to be killed in a particular way. I think that's wrong. What the text literally says is, you must not eat meat with the life that is the blood. In other words, although man is given permission to eat the meat of animals, he is not to eat living flesh. He can be a farmer or a hunter, but he must not eat the flesh of a living creature. Animals will begin to devour other animals while still alive. They will sink tooth and claw into its prey, but man must not. He must first kill the animal, cook the animal, and then eat the animal. Most of us are squeamish about blood. And I wonder, does that squeamishness stem from this ancient taboo? So man is to utilize creation, but he is not to exploit it. He is to be a meat eater, but that meat must be harvested in a humane and kind way. And of course, the application to that extends wider than the eating of meat. He is to care for the environment that God has given him. He's not to pollute the atmosphere. He's not to poison the rivers or destroy the scenery by building ugly monstrosities in a view. God has given him creation, but under the covenant, he has an obligation to respect creation, to use creation for the glory of God. So he is to utilize creation, he is to respect creation, and then he is to govern creation. Look at verse 6. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God has made man in his own image. Man is an image bearer of God. That's what distinguishes him from the animals. And that's why animals can be slaughtered and humans must not be slaughtered. He is an image bearer of God. Now that's very important in terms of theology. Because there are some people who believe that although Adam was made in the image of God, when Adam fell, that image was destroyed and ruined and taken away. But the basis of respecting human life is that man is still an image bearer of God. So in the fall, the image is ruined, but not removed, distorted, but not destroyed, twisted, but not taken away. So when we were children, we used to take the big old pre-decimalization pennies. I'm not recommending this to anybody, especially the children. Used to take them, a bit of a rebel when I was young, used to take these pennies and we used to put them on the railway lines, tracks, and we used to wait for the train to pass over them. And when you picked up the piece of copper afterwards, you could see the image of the Queen, distorted, but not destroyed, ruined, but not removed. Traces of the image remained on that coin. Now, man is still an image bearer of God, and that makes life separate. And wherever that principle is undermined, the consequences are horrific. So what happened in Nazi Germany? Well, in Nazi Germany, Hitler dehumanized the Jews. So those propaganda films of rats running through the sewers with the faces of Jews superimposed on top of them. Well, they're no more than animals, so you can exterminate almost 7 million Jews. Slavery. So if you dehumanize the black, or any other race for that matter, then you can own them. Like a man owns a horse or cattle, and they become an implement and a tool. You dehumanize. Or abortion. So you don't refer to the baby in the womb as a baby unless you're part of the royal family and Meghan Markle. And they keep talking about her baby. They never talk about the fetus in the womb, her baby. But if you dehumanize the fetus, well, you can dispose of it as you want. You know, since 1967, there have been 7 million abortions carried out in the UK. That's why people call it the silent Holocaust. It's this dehumanizing, devaluing of life. And that's why this principle is underscored in chapter 9. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God has made man in his own image. That human beings are valuable to God. It's a serious breach of the covenant to take life. And if you take life, your life should be taken. God is instituting human government here. And he's saying that governments, in order to underscore the sacredness of life, have the right to take the life of a murderer. Remember a number of years ago, there was like a mini revival that happened in the prisons during the height of the Troubles. And a number of people were converted and came to faith, and they used to baptize each other in the bath. And sort of all the four major denominations had chaplains, but they requested that they would have a Baptist chaplain, but the Northern Ireland office refused. And so they got a meeting of the prisoners together, the Christian prisoners who were really militant in their attitude. And, you know, some were shouting and protesting, and they were saying, well, you know, these are our rights. This is our right that we should have our own chaplain. In fact, they were going to form themselves into a Baptist church. They were going to constitute a Baptist church in prison. HMP McGabry Baptist Church. Wisely, they didn't. But they were protesting and they were shouting and they were giving off. And then one of the prisoners was very quiet. And they said to him, he was a greatly respected man, they said, why are you so quiet? Why are you not insisting on rights? He says, well, if I got justice and got my rights, he says, I would be hanging at the end of a rope. To take life, you forfeit life. And it seems to me, to underscore the sacredness of life, that was never revoked. In Romans 13, Paul talks about governments being ordained by God, the powers that be, and he adds, they do not bear the sword for nothing. They do not bear the sword for nothing. And you say, well, you think of all the miscarriages of justice, the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, and all those miscarriages of justice, and I agree 100%. I'm not sure I would trust our government or our legal system to implement this properly. I'm not sure I would. But that doesn't alter the principle that human life is sacred. And if you take a person's life because they're an image bearer of God, the state has the right to take your life. The promise of the covenant, the basis of the covenant, the obligations of the covenant, to utilize creation, to respect creation, to govern creation. Lastly, in verses 12 to 15, the sign of the covenant. Have you ever wondered why a couple give a ring to each other on their wedding day? Well, it's a token of the covenant that they have made. That's actually in the marriage ceremony. I give you this ring as a token of the covenant made between us this day. So in the dark days, in the difficult days, when they fall out, as inevitably they will, the husband or the wife can look at that ring. I don't wear a ring. But they can look at that ring and they can remember that covenant. Well, God spreads his ring across the sky. And in verse 16, he says, I will see it and remember. Now, John Calvin says, God never forgets, so God doesn't need to remember. That rainbow is for our benefit, because when we see it, we remember that God remembers, that God doesn't forget his promises, that God doesn't forget his covenant. And it embraces the whole world. It extends to all creation. I want you to think about this. This word bow is exactly the same word in Hebrew that it is in English. It refers to an archer's bow. So that bow reminds us, well, you say to me, it doesn't look like a bow. Well, it does if it's pulled. It's a pull bow. That's the shape of it, isn't it? It's a bow that is drawn. And that bow reminds us that God is still angry with sin. That he still sees that the intentions and inclinations of man's heart are to evil all the time. His bow is drawn. He is angry. But here's the grace. That bow points away from the earth, not to the earth. Do you see that? The bow is extended, but the bow points away from the earth. In fact, it points to heaven and to God himself. And in that sign, I think there is an anticipation of the cross, that God himself will bear wrath in his body on that tree. That the second person of the Trinity would enflesh himself, come into our world and go to the cross, and he will be the focus of the anger and judgment of God. Isn't that wonderful? So every time you see that bow, it's an extended bow. We might say the rifle has been cocked. It's an extended bow. God is still angry, but we remember his promise to Noah. That anger is directed away from the earth, and it's directed heaven itself. Amen.